So, we talked about the physical, got into the emotional, talked a little bit about spiritual recovery. There are so many different directions this morning. I've been thinking about, I can go this way, I can go this way. I mean, it really is an exciting topic because really the entire program is spiritual when you get down to it. And I think what's important to reflect upon is when you go back and take a look at the founders, Bill Wilson, Dr. Bob. You know, Bill Wilson is a very, very, very interesting human being. If you can ever listen to a tape of his, it's fascinating because he sounds like just the classic salesman. I mean, he's got that in his voice, and he's going to sell you something, and he's a good salesman. And, you know, he was a smart guy. He was a very successful guy. He basically invented or helped to invent what is known as fundamental research on Wall Street. You know, and when you read the big book, him and Lois going out and visiting companies and writing up reports and bringing it to the Wall Street, the idea that there would be research about a company that you would invest in and know something about it was no one had ever done that. It was a revolutionary concept. And he was the first person. Today it is a multi-billion-dollar business. And Bill Wilson came up with the idea saying, hey, if I can get information about a company to investors, I could make money. Because most people lost money because they didn't understand what they were investing in. Revolutionary concept. If you listen to him talk in his talks, you know, he wanted to start a chain of hospitals across the country, franchise them, get alcoholics sober. I mean, he had the whole recovery business in his head with treatment centers in the 1940s. And Dr. Bob said, whoa, easy now. Let's focus on the basics. Love and service, 12 steps. But you could tell Bill was the promoter out there. And for a guy to, and he'd be quoted in the newspaper, he made a lot of money, he was followed by a lot of people, and then to fall and end up not being able to get a job, drunk, living in Brooklyn, little apartment, his wife had to go to work, and then he has this spiritual awakening in the hospital. And then from there, going into AA. And while it's wonderful that he did that, I'm sure he wanted the glories of Wall Street. And Time Magazine wanted to make him Man of the Year. And he said no. And his wife said he made sure that everyone in his life knew that he turned it down. The guy had an ego. He's a human being. He was a very flawed human being. But yet his life was devoted to service. And when you read through the 12 and 12 and you read about his personal history, he was going through a great depression during this time. It was the 1940s, and he had started this movement, and he wanted his old wife back, but then there's something terribly new and exciting, and he was involved with, but he also knew him and Bob couldn't carry this thing alone. And the depression lifted in the 1950s when they created the World Service Organization and created a structure in which AA could continue without them. And so, you know, he was a guy that suffered just as much as all of us did. He was always a searcher, though. You know, I mean, it's not talked about much. I mean, he went and dropped acid because he figured that might be the answer. And they're like, maybe not. You know, but he was a searcher, and he was always looking for spiritual truths. He got into practicing. He was not raised Catholic. He became a Catholic later in life. He decided to choose that route for some aspects of his spirituality. And it's very interesting, you know, one of the things that comes back, I think, with this concept of spirituality is action. Is action. And it's a lot of things, and you see clues in the book about action. And, you know, part of what he did was showing at meetings, carrying the message. You know, there's a lot of things about, you know, becoming a sponsor is a spiritual activity. You know, being allowed to be sponsored can be a spiritual activity. Showing up at a meeting when there's the same three people who talk about the same problems week in, week out, and you want to kill yourself. Showing up and being a witness is spirituality. You know, you're showing up and representing the program. You're being there for a fellow. You're trying to carry the message. That is a spiritual move. It doesn't have to be this connection always. We don't always feel that connection. I think it was quite a revelation when St. Teresa, you know, published her, when it came out about her diaries and letters about, she wasn't sure if she believed there was a God at one point. And it was really, she had deep crises of faith. And you think, well, Mother Teresa, you know, she's having a tough time with this. What chance do I have? Yet she was a human being. And so the 12 steps really are the roadmap to find your spirituality, whatever that might be. And the nice thing is that AA puts it on us. We had to come up with our own concept of a higher power. And that was the thing that got Bill as he was sitting drunk, you know, in his apartment, and his friend Eddie came to see him. And he thought, okay, the old boy got religion. And he goes, oh, that's it. Okay, I got it. I can keep drinking. He can keep his sobriety. And his friend Eddie said, Bill, why don't you come up with your own concept of God? It's up to you. And that struck him. And all of the defiance that he had, all of the anti-religious bias that he had melted away in that moment. Because now there was no excuse. It was his own concept that he could create from the ground up. And that was the door that opened it. And, you know, it talks about, and I found this in the big book. And I used to have a sponsor who loved talking about this passage in the big book. And it's on page 13. And I'll just read a little bit of you. And this was after he did step 3, turned his will and his life over to the care of his higher power. And this was when he was in the apartment with Eddie, the guy who carried the message of AA before AA existed and who died drunk. My schoolmate visited me, and I fully acquainted with him my problems and deficiencies. We made a list of persons I had hurt and toward whom I felt resentment. Sound familiar? I expressed my entire willingness to approach these individuals, admitting my wrong. Never was I to be critical of them. I was to right all such matters to the utmost of my ability. You know, doing steps 8 and 9. I was to test my thinking by the new God consciousness within. Common sense would thus become uncommon sense. I was to sit quietly when in doubt, asking only for direction and strength to meet my problems as he would have me. Never was I to pray for myself, except as my requests bore on my usefulness to others. Then only might I expect to receive, but that would be in great measure. My friend promised, when these things were done, I'd enter into upon a new relationship with my Creator, that I would have the elements of a way of living which answered all my problems, belief in the power of God, plus enough willingness, honesty, and humility to establish and maintain the new order of things were the essential requirements. Simple, but not easy. Here's the important point. A price had to be paid. It meant destruction of self-centeredness. I must turn all things to the Father of Life who presides over us all. These were revolutionary and drastic proposals, but at the moment I fully accepted them, the effect was electric. There was a sense of victory followed by such a peace and serenity I'd never known. There was utter confidence. I felt lifted up as through the great clean wind of a mountaintop blew through and through. God comes to most men gradually, but his impact on me was sudden and profound. So that was his spiritual awakening, you know, after he did the steps. And that's what we talk about in step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result. So your singular result of doing all the 12 steps is having a spiritual awakening. Maybe not as profound as Bill Wilson's, but to have a spiritual awakening. And so after he, you know, looked at his inventory, became willing to make amends to them all, then he would turn over everything to his higher power. That was the price ticket to basically spiritual peace. And so I think about that and you think, well, how do I do that? How do I turn over everything want to do that. So a lot of it is practical every day. And a lot of times when we look at spirituality, we talk about spiritual practices such as prayer, meditation, and those are indispensable. They're very important. But there are other things. Practicing spirituality in relationships with kids that don't listen, with cooperative or uncooperative spouses, with a boss at work that has it out for you. How do I practice spirituality in those cases? And that's really where it becomes very difficult. It's very easy for me to sit for 5 minutes and meditate, but that just sets me up for the day. That's really all it does. What I have to do is carry this out into all aspects of my life and do that. And the problem is sometimes I get caught up in the relationships. You know, how did I get into another argument again? I worked so hard on this, and then yet every time I have a conversation with my mother, I get into the same thing. What happened? She threw me in, and then before you know it, we're at it. You know, and I think, God, all this work I did is a waste of time. And so there was a couple of exercises people have given me, and it's good because people remind me of some things over the weekend. And Beverly reminded me of this yesterday, and it was called the drama triangle. And I use that a lot of times to figure out, where am I spiritually in this relationship? And it's very helpful in very, very specific situations to decide whether to wade in or take a step back and go, you know, best of luck to you. So the drama triangle is very simple. How do I know there's drama going on? You know, there can be times when there's a lot of emotion, rightfully so, in a relationship or a specific situation with a relationship that we need to deal with. That's life. But then there's also drama. And drama doesn't really help anybody. And so I need to have a victim, a perpetrator, and a rescuer. So, you know, I'm always the victim, of course. And there could be a perpetrator. Could be my mother. She's on the warpath. Oh, God. You know. And then who's going to be the rescuer? Who's going to be the one that comes in and fixes it? Sometimes I can play two or all three of those roles. And so sometimes I have to step back from the relationship and go, okay, what's going on here? Can I identify all three players in this relationship? Well, sometimes the perpetrator and the rescuer are the same person. Sometimes it can be a different combination. But if I can name all three of the characters in this specific situation, I've got drama going on. And what I have to do is step back and get out of the situation and say, tell you what, I know we need to discuss this, but this is not the right time for me to delve into this with you. And remove myself, protect myself. That's self-care. I never knew that was happening. It's not program approved, but it's a very useful construct for me, especially with family who are not in the program, to interact with them in a healthy and safe manner. So I always use that, and you know, I don't have to say, well, this is just a bunch of goddamn drama. You know, here you are stirring it up again. It's not the purpose of that. It's really for me to say, uh-oh, this is a dangerous situation, and it's a no-win situation. Let me step back and then try and be loving, and that is practicing spirituality. And practicing spirituality in relationships is very difficult, especially if you're dating. Paul reminded me of this. He was talking earlier about camel. He mentioned camel, and I go, I forgot to talk about the camel. So thank you, Paul, for reminding me. He's like, oh, okay. And, you know, spirituality and dating. A lot of people aren't dating. They're already in committed relationships. But this one piece of information I always pass on. My sponsor taught it to me, and it is the only reason I am in a relationship today. The only reason I am in a relationship today. Because, you know, I was the person in a relationship that would, if you were interested in me, I had to overwhelm, control, make sure you weren't going to get away, and take you hostage. long-term relationships were not born of that, you know, approach. And I couldn't figure out, I'm like, well, I'm such a nice guy. I killed him with kindness, and they all run away, you know? You didn't want to be controlled and manipulated. That was, and I also was selling a bill of goods that I could not follow up with, you know? And I was lying. And so I had a sponsor who, in today's world, this is actually stunning if you can do it. And he's like, well, you can make one phone call a week. Really? And you can ask this person out on a date. You know, if they're in the meetings, it's not like, oh, hey, let's go out after words for coffee or something. No, you got to go and make it really clear what your intentions are. And then after that, speak to them once a week and go out once a week. He's like, really? He goes, yeah, don't call them 15 times a day or text them or do this other stuff, because that's all about making sure that you're okay with them. That has nothing to do with the relationship. You're just checking in to make sure that you're still okay with them, and that's not a relationship. And it gets really tedious after about a week. So, you know, I started dating, now my wife, but at the time my girlfriend, and I guess we're going out a few weeks, and she's like, we need to have a talk about the relationship. And I was like, oh God. I call my sponsor. I go, what do? I don't know what she wants to talk about. It's the relationship. I don't know. Maybe she's upset about something. And he goes, well, there's nothing to talk about. You have no relationship. We're going out a few weeks. I go, she wants to talk about this. What do I can't say no. I mean, I can avoid it. And, you know, what do? And he goes, it's very simple. Go have that talk. But tell her before you have the talk, I can only do it on one condition. I still use this today. With my wife. She doesn't like it. She laughs. You know, she remembers. She laughs. And she's like, okay, I see where you're going. So, talk about the relationship, but you cannot use the word relationship. Instead of relationship, use the word camel. I'm like, what? Camel. I'm good. Good. I'm worried about the relationship. I'm worried about the camel. You're putting a lot of pressure on the camel. And if you want this camel to work out, you're going to spend more time with the camel. Yeah. And I started laughing. I said, that's stupid. He goes, exactly. Exactly. You're talking about a relationship and as if it is a third person. It is a real entity. He says, relationships come about through a series of shared experiences. And then from that, you build and get to know someone. Having discussions about a relationship does never build a relationship. So for your first year, you cannot have a discussion about the relationship. You can only talk about the camel. I go, okay, I'll tell you what happens. I was not buying that. So, go have the talk. And I said, before we begin and talk about the relationship, because I know there's some things you want to talk to me about, I have one request. She said, okay. I said, and do not use the word relationship. Please use the word camel. She's like, what? I said, just go with it. And so we started getting into it, and I said, relationship, camel. She goes, okay, so the camel. And she started laughing, and she goes, this is stupid. And I go, yeah, it is. And I explained to her the reasoning behind it, and she laughed. And whatever that problem was dissipated, because having a discussion was not going to solve whatever her issue was about the relationship. Because there was no relationship. It was about whatever I was doing or not doing that was causing some issues with her. And we didn't have the vocabulary to say, you know, you say you're going to do this and then you don't do it. And that bugs me. I said, we have to have a talk about the relationship. So it becomes more direct. And so those two little things really helped me in the spirituality of a relationship. And so I passed those on. And that is the only reason I'm married today, is because of using the camel and the relationships. Because at the end of the day, a relationship, like it or not, it's all these other wonderful things, but it is a power struggle. And it's about trying sometimes to get, if that person isn't going to do what you want them to do or act in the way that you want them to act, is how do I get them to do that? And that's human nature. And how do we get around to doing that? And that's where the steps come in, and that's where we get to do an inventory process, and we get to see our motives and our ancient fears, you know. And then when there's a big blow up, you know, as they say in Al-Anon, you know, if it's hysterical, it's historical. You know, if there's a big blow up going on, whether it's at work with me, chances are it's not about that thing at the moment, but it's about something in the past that's now coming out. And I have to, you know, step back and say, okay, we're going to take this with just a little bit more kid gloves, because I don't know what the problem is, but I know it's not this issue that's standing in front of us. I have to take the high road. That's practicing spirituality and relationships. You know, and it's trusting, and at the base of all this is trusting that I'm being taken care of. You know, I live in fear of losing that relationship or losing something. It talks about in step seven, you know, basically we're living in on a basis of unsatisfied demands. You know, our character defects were out of control because we were afraid of losing what we had or not getting what we want. And we could no longer live on this basis of an unsatisfied demand. The difference between a request and a demand was simple. And so we have to move from, after we've done our inventory process, to get to that point of a get out of fear. So when we approach any interaction with a colleague, neighbor, wife, loved one, child, it's not through the basis of fear. It's from the basis of love. That whatever comes out of that, it's okay, and it's all part of my higher power's plan. My job is not to understand my higher power's plan, but to go along with it. You know, why does this happen? Why does this bad thing happen in the world? You know, how can, if there's a God, allow it to happen? And for me, what I've come to is it's not that it's my higher power allowing it to happen. It's my higher power that gives me the strength to walk through whatever is happening. It's a different role. It's non-linear. It's non-intellectual. You know, people. You know, if there's not a paradox, don't trust it in the program, they say. And I think there's some truth in that.
Yeah.
You know, the spiritual way is not a straightforward path. There is, by the way, a non-program approved literature that if you are sort of a history geek, an intellectual, and really want to delve into the steps in a fascinating manner, there's a book called Not God by Kurtz, K-U-R-T-Z. This is the classic. He was a graduate student and philosophical history and popular history. And he was studying the 1920s and 30s. And he decided to do his thesis in graduate school on AA and the elements that created AA. And he was not an alcoholic. You hear that thing, oh, yeah, I'm actually a graduate student coming to meetings. I'm not an alcoholic. He did become an alcoholic and did, you know, come into AA later on. But it is his thesis, you can get it on Amazon, that goes in and delves into the creation of AA, the creation of the 12 and 12, and the 12 steps, the philosophy behind it, where everything comes from. And it is a fascinating history, intellectual history, into the basis of the steps. Yes?
How do you spell his name?
K-U-R-T-Z. And his concept, not God, is that the strength of AA was in admitting they had no strength. That the strength was that we are not God. That is the sole focus that we have. And the reason why AA was so successful, we don't have the answers. We have an answer. And what was fascinating is that when we go back to Bill Wilson's friend, Evie, who came in and carried the message, Evie got sober from a guy named Roland, who had visited Carl Jung over in Switzerland to try and get sober. And it didn't really work. And Carl Jung, and near the end of the treatment, Roland asked Carl, he goes, well, what are my chances? And he goes, not good. I've never really seen anyone get sober who is a real chronic alcoholic. And occasionally it works once in a while, but it doesn't really happen. And so Roland did stay sober. He got Evie sober, who got Bill sober. Evie did not stay sober. And years later, Bill Wilson wrote a letter to Carl Jung just to let him know, hey, guess what? That discussion you had with Roland and getting him sober, it's turned into this fantastic movement, and we just wanted to let you know about it. And Carl Jung wrote back, and it was a fascinating letter, and you can see it in the archives, and I think you can see it in some of the other literature. And he's, you know, that's really great. It's really fascinating. And he talked about, you know, this, there were two things, you know, to conquer the evil that we have, the character defects, is an amazing thing. He said, but one of the elements that's needed is a community to support one another in their spiritual endeavors. And that, he says, seems to be what AA has created and the reason for its success. And so it's not enough for us to, you know, I hear so many talks about spirituality and practicing spirituality in the program, and it's often an individual practice, and it's not. It's really a community that we have here to hold up each other in their spiritual practices and to continue on a daily basis. And that's, you know, through showing up at a meeting, showing up here this weekend, being a sponsor, sponsoring people, and creating that community that we can all grow. And there are other communities out there. Religions have tried to do this for years, and to a large extent, they do a very good job of it. But obviously, there were some unanswered issues that they weren't addressing, and the 12 steps have been able to come in a very unique way. And really, not add anything new. There's nothing new in AA. It's just a combination, a unique combination of things that has brought it together to make it a very, very successful approach to addiction in our lives. So, you know, when we get back to, you know, the 12th step and the 12th step is carrying the message. So we're doing the 12th step when we show up at a meeting. We're doing the 12th step when we're carrying the message. We're doing the 12th step when we're listening to an inventory process. You know, we talked about the inventory process. You know, mine's one way. I got it out of the book. There's other interpretations. There's other worksheets. The important thing is not how you do it. It's that you do it. And so that is the thing that is so important. So when we get into, you know, our concept of God, you know, a lot of people are put off, of course, when they see the 12 steps for the first time and God. And, you know, it's interesting, you know, in the third step, where we turn our will and our lives over to the care of a higher power, not control, to the care. So let's think about that care and what that care looks like. A mother cares for a child. So, you know, it's a different approach to a higher power. And we know we've done the third step when we're ready to put pen to paper and expose ourselves in the inventory process. That's something that really nobody likes to do. And if we know we've really worked the step when we've got that stuff down on paper. And then again, you know, we go through the steps and then we get to taking a personal inventory again, constantly taking a look at what's my part, how can I improve, where am I at fault? And this constantly taking a look at ourselves is that spiritual practice. And then when we get into step 11, prayer and meditation, there's a couple of examples that Bill talks about. And at this point, he sort of feels, you know, there's a couple of debates about believing in a higher power, not believing in a higher power, atheism, etc. And, you know, my sponsor's an atheist, and he's got a wonderful spiritual practice. So I think the difference between having a higher power in your life and not having a higher power in your life, it really, the existence is that difference. You know, my life is so much better having a concept of a higher power in my life. I don't have to define it. You know, I was raised Catholic, didn't really do much for me, became very involved after I got sober in the Episcopal Church. They all needed a program, from what I could tell. And, so, you know, I sort of backed away. I'm still involved in some ways, administratively, but doing service. But, you know, for me, it comes back to the construct of the 12 steps, and the program is where I get my spirituality today. The other stuff, ritual, dogma, that's all very important. But is this essential to my spirituality? Not really. So when we get into the 11th step, you know, it talks about prayer and meditation. And it talks about, throughout the book, there's little clues. We don't pray for ourselves. You know, we pray to be of service to others. And underlying that concept is that our higher power already knows what we need. You know, I just always want to make sure. You know, I think, yeah, I know that my higher power knows what I need, but let me just spell it out in my terms. And that's unnecessary. If I really have a true faith, I am being taken care of. And I've always been taken care of. And those coincidences that I saw, those miracles, they take place whether I believe in a higher power or I don't believe in a higher power. They take place whether I'm in OA or not in OA. It takes place whether I'm abstinent or not abstinent. The difference is that when I'm abstinent, working the steps, and in OA, I put on the glasses and I can see them. I can see those miracles very, very clearly happening in front of me. And it's amazing and it's delightful. If I'm not abstinent, I'm not in the program, the glasses come off, the miracles are happening, I just don't see them. And so I don't believe. Because I see no example, no concrete results. But when I'm in the program, if I'm putting on a new pair of glasses, I see those miracles happen, and it's very clear to me. So, you know, there's prayer, there's meditation. They talk about meditation. And I think they use the prayer of St. Francis of Assisi. And what's fascinating about that prayer is that it's all action. You know, it's better to love than to be loved, to forgive than to, you know, be forgiven. It's very little, let me contemplate the truth. They're all action steps. So to me, the clue is action. You know, I'll use that sometimes. My sponsor's like, why don't you work on that? I'm like, why should I work on that and meditate on that? He goes, because you need to get out of self. And you're going to get out of self by directing towards others. It's not, here, let me get my spirituality in. Let me get it for me. It's, I have to direct out. That's how I get the spirituality. I'm going to love if I want to be loved. I got to forgive if I want to be forgiven. You know, if I want light in my life, you know, if I want to get rid of the darkness, I need to bring the light. It's like, well, she can apologize first. I'm not apologizing. She is the one who started this. I got to bring the light. If I want light in my life, I'm the one who has to bring it in. So I can't wait for that other person and hope that's going to happen. And then become resentful when it doesn't happen. That's not spirituality. So spirituality is really a lot of action steps. You know, another prayer that I use, not program, is I'll read the Desiderata. You know, it was written by an insurance salesman in the 1920s. People thought it came from St. Paul's Cathedral in the 1600s because it was found by Adlai Stevens, who ran for president in 1950 on the Democratic ticket. When he died, he had a copy of that on his bedside, and it said St. Paul's Cathedral, Baltimore, 1620, and it was printed by St. Paul's Cathedral in Baltimore, which was founded in 1620, but it was very recent, but there was a mistake. People just mistaken, oh, this must be from 1620, and it was an unknown writer. Well, it wasn't. It was a guy named Max Ehrman, and I think it was Boise, Idaho. Not the most spiritual of origins, but it's a wonderful meditation. I won't even call it a prayer, but I use it. You know, go placidly, you know, amidst the haste, and just walk through life slowly. Savor what's going on, and know that you're being taken care of. And you know, the sentiment that, let's see if I got internet. No internet. So. The thing of it is to know that I'm a child of God and I'm being taken care of and I have just as much right to be here as the trees. And that's a very comforting thought. So I use that meditation sometimes when I'm doing prayer meditation. And for me, I now, as a spiritual practice, you know, when I get up in the morning, shower, go for a run if I'm going to go for a run, come back, shower, get my breakfast together. And then before I sit down to eat, I take about anywhere from 3 to 6, 7 minutes, and I just get quiet, and I meditate, and I think about either just breathing quietly and with my eyes closed, or sometimes I will use a mantra, a word, just to focus my mind if my mind is racing, and it doesn't matter what the word is, just to focus the mind. And then after that, you know, my little alarm on my phone goes off, I may do read something like a meditation or just for today. For many years I did just for today, and then just think about you know, what it talks about, that thought and the prayer, and or I'll say, you know, the St. Francis prayer, and then that's it. And I may ask, you know, for my higher power strength for, you know, so and so who's going through cancer treatment today. But they have the strength to get through it, and that they, you know, at least know that they're going to be okay. But again, not praying for myself. And then I go about my day. And there are times where you do the spot check inventory they talk about, restraint of tongue and pen. Sometimes I have to stop and say, you know what? I need to go walk around the block. I'll be back. I have to remove myself from the situation. I know sometimes when I'm getting too worked up about, usually at work, I need to take a walk. And I just literally breathe, walk around the block, come back in, and continue. And I just take that pause. You know, a lot of the program for me is avoiding the wreckage of the future. You know, I don't like writing inventories. So I think sometimes, is this going to be an inventory? Keep your mouth shut. You know, avoiding a lot of the program becomes avoiding the wreckage of the future. You know, in my first 2 years, I went back and did another inventory, and most of the inventory and amends had to do with stuff that I did in recovery, not way back when. I was still creating a lot of chaos in the early years of recovery because I'd shoot my mouth off, or I knew what everybody had to do. You just, come on, you need to get with the program here. And you need to do it my way and really alienate people and then get, you know, why are they so upset with me? I'm just trying to help. And just be bewildered about the firestorm I created and not having any clue. So I really try hard a lot of the times to avoid the wreckage of my future by restraining tongue and pen, taking a few minutes, trying to think about that. And all of that becomes more second nature as I've gone through the steps. So a lot of people want to sort of strip away the spirituality into a separate box, and I think that's a big mistake. It is the box. You know, also, too, it's so much of our lives depend upon perspective, and I talked about allowing bad ideas in and thinking nice thoughts. And the thing of it is as we sit here, some of the spirituality you might think, kind of passive. You know, my job is to accept what goes on in reality. Well, maybe I need to stand up and make a change here. You know, I don't like what's going on, and I need to raise my voice and talk about it. Isn't there a place for that? You know, you think, listening to spirituality and my approach to life, that there isn't. And there is. You know, and the question is, you know, is it all predestined, or do I have free will here? And the answer is yes.
Yeah.
It's both. And I'll give you a great example. I believe whatever's going to happen is going to happen. So I might as well go along with it. Because the pain comes in me resisting either trying to drag someone back into my life that should be gone, or trying to pull someone in before they're supposed to be there, or trying to create and keep a situation alive that really shouldn't be alive. And so I have to let go and go with the flow. Yet, I have no control. And a great way to think about this is how I look at life every day. And this is the most spiritual way I can think about it, is that a family moves in next door to me. That's what happens. A really loud Mexican family, playing music, screaming kids, a lot of people sitting outside in the driveway every night, keeping me up, really pain in the ass. Moved in next door to me. Mexican family moves in next door to me. Loving family, great kids. They're always trying to bring over something for me. You know, hey, we just made this here, have some. enjoy it. It'll be a great dinner for you. Loving, fantastic. What I know is a Mexican family moved in next door to me. So, God's will are the verbs. I'm in charge of the adjectives in my life. So, the same family moved in. Same behavior. They're really fantastic. And I love them to death. And they love me. And we have a great relationship. Or, oh my God. And you can know, I just use Mexican because I live in Southern California. But it could be anything. It could be the boss. So, what I have to do is strip away my adjectives. That's my free will. That's how I view the world, is through the adjectives. My higher power is not doing anything to me. It's happening. It's the verb. It's my decision. It's my perspective. And it's my adjectives that create that world. And I can change it. I have the power, through the steps, through perspective, to change my reality. Where else can I do that in the world? There is nothing else out there that allows me to, in an instant, change my reality and to change my past. You know, I go back and, oh, my childhood and this, and there was chaos and there was fighting, and my mother was like a mafia don, and, you know, there was no love, and it was just, ugh. Yeah, all of that's true. Also, the mother who is very loving, who loved her kids, loved them in the best way possible, tried to provide every opportunity to them. You know, it's somewhere in the middle. And so I look much less harshly on my childhood based upon changing some of the adjectives on how I describe my childhood. And I'm very careful today how I talk about things. If I find a lot of negative words coming out in the description, I now go, oh, wait a minute here. Why the negativity? What's going on about that? I remember when I lived in France, there was a guy in the program, a guy named Don. He was in AA. He came to speak to some of the OA meetings because it was back when there was like no recovery. So we, you know, bring in the old the AA heavy hitters to go, you know, tell their story, give some recovery. And Don was an amazing guy. He's dead now. And he had about 17 years recovery at one point, and his wife was dying of cancer. And she died. And he came home the next day, and his son had killed himself. He was 17. He was distraught over his mother's death and really felt like he didn't want to go on. And he goes, in that instant, I lost my family. And I had 17 years of sobriety. And, yeah, I was kind of involved with meetings. And, yeah, kind of, you know, did the thing, but really did the thing. And he goes, and I got in the car, and I drove around Paris for the next 5 hours, afraid to get out of my car because I'd either kill myself or drink myself to death out of grief. And the thought that kept coming back was, why am I here? Why am I here? And the answer came in that five-hour drive, just driving around the city, that I'm here for a purpose, and I need to find out what that was. And what it came out was love and service. Because I'm here for love and service. Otherwise, I'd be dead too. And his whole life became devoted to the program. And I run into people around the world, and I mentioned Don's name from Paris, and they know exactly who this guy is. And he was just a fantastic embodiment of spirituality through the 12 steps. And it was a very uncomplicated spirituality. And at the time when I lived in Paris, people were doing Vedanticism and using Vedantic philosophy as an overlay. When I lived in London, a lot of people use sort of a Buddhist overlay with the 12 steps. And it was fascinating to see how they did that and going to different parts of the world with different religious philosophies where they sort of picked and choose and used it as an overlay to sort of enhance, almost like spices and flavors of the 12 steps to get gain a slightly different perspective or viewpoint on the spirituality that the 12 steps had. Because it can really incorporate anything, and it would highlight different things. And so I think about that today. What is my purpose? What is my purpose in life? And yes, I'm a husband, and yes, I'm a father, and I'm an employee. But what if all that's taken away? What if I have a situation like Don had, where my wife died and my kids died? Then what is my purpose? And that's where I come back to, so important, when we identify, hi, I'm Peter. I don't say, hi, I'm Peter, I'm a father and a husband and an employee. I'm like, no, I'm Peter, I'm a compulsive overeater. That's my purpose. And it's very important, and it's a very spiritual approach, because all that other stuff, all those identifiers in my life can be taken away from me in tragic ways. But I still have something here, which is OA. And then I have a purpose, which is the 12 steps in being of service. Much like Don was. And he had an amazing life. I hear he died a few years ago. When I knew him, he was in his 70s, and that was 35 years ago. So I think he died about 10, 12 years ago. And just a fantastic person. And what was amazing was his sunny optimism. At the time, I had a sponsor. Don was his sponsor, and I can't go into it too much because one, it's AA, doesn't really relate, but he went on the lam. He was wanted by the authorities. He's still wanted years later, so I can't say I've been in touch with him, and I called Don up, and I go, he skipped the country. And he goes, yeah, you'll be fine. How are you? I go, Don, you got to. This is some serious business here. What's going on? Just yeah, I know. It'll be fine. It's all going to work out. I go, how do you know it's going to work out, Don? He goes, because it always does. And once you begin looking at it, and it was amazing. I asked him, how is this going on? How's that? He goes, oh yeah, it's fine. And what was amazing is in the 1980s, where the OA meetings were. And the AA meetings, they were at the American Church on Quai d'Orsay. Right next to it was the South African Embassy. And a lot of times, there was a lot of protests back in the 1980s dealing with apartheid. And you'd have to walk through riot police and crowds to get to a meeting. Literally. I was just like, no, I'm going to the church. And sometimes you had to really fight to get to that OA meeting. And, it was a little tense. And I go, this is ridiculous. We got to change the meeting. He goes, oh, it's all fine. And I go, how is it all fine? He goes, well, you're here, I'm here, we've got a meeting, we had to work a little harder, but it's all good. I thought, okay, man, this dude is senile or something. But the reality of it was, he chose in every situation to look for the positive. I can focus on, I had to go through a bunch of riot police, and he goes, how hard was that? You just said you were going to the church. They could hear your American accent. It's not a big deal. I'm like, okay, I see your point. And so I have to consciously choose in every situation the positive approach. And that doesn't mean to be Pollyannish. It doesn't mean, oh, I'm going to gloss over all the problems and not look at it. No, they're there. But I can choose in each circumstances to decide how I want this to go. How I choose to look at it, and it goes back to all of those choices. I can have a fight with my girlfriend about the relationship, or we can have a discussion about the camel. And it can, we can approach whatever the issues are with a little bit of lightness and humor. And guess what? That really gets, we can get to the heart of the issue sometimes a lot quicker than we can, sitting down and headbutting each other to talk about the relationship. It's all about a choice and a perspective. And what the 12 steps, if you go through and do this, and you do the inventory process, and you clean up the past, and you get rid of the shame through the behavior of past relationships by making amends, we become clean. And we can approach without fear, without hiding, without waiting for them to really find out who we are. A lot of us walk around saying, well, if they really knew what I was like, they wouldn't be my friend. They wouldn't have hired me. They wouldn't have married me. Wouldn't have allowed me in that club. And what the program tells us is all of that is unimportant. In fact, it's an asset. Because you're going to use that dark past. you've gone through the steps to help that other person who's mired in shame, cannot get out of it, and show them that there's a path. And that is the most spiritual thing you can do, is, you know, putting your hand and mind. And together we can do what we cannot do alone. That is the essence of spirituality. And so, you know, the prayer and meditation that we do is really about just a quick reminder every day, encapsulating what it is that we're doing with the steps, working towards that spirituality. And, you know, the other thing is people, you know, we look at other people and say, oh, that's, they work a great program. They're down 50 pounds. Their life is back together. Blah, 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 blah. Or, well, they put on weight. Wife left them. Got fired. Heard like he was stealing something, you know. You know, the talk, you know, it begins. And the reality of it is that maybe God's script for this person right now is for it not to be very good. Why? I don't know. But then out of that comes something else. You know, out of it comes some very, very important lessons that they have to learn, or it positions them for the next phase of their life. I'll give you a great example. I had a sponsee who had a very good friend. Being in Southern California, he worked in the adult film industry. This will become important in a moment. And he introduced a nice young lady to his friend in New York, who was in the adult film industry. And this guy was a very prestigious analyst. So this was something very quiet. You know, sort of out there in the press, similar things today. And so it came out that he was talking to her about deals. You know, it's big investment deals that he was doing that was not public information. And she was turning around and telling her friends who were then investing and making money off of this. And when it came out, he was, you know, disgraced, front page newspapers, lost his job, lost any chance of working in the business, did a little jail time, I believe. He was never going to work again in the business. And he was disgraced. And my sponsee, his friend, felt horrified because he had introduced those two. Not with any intention that all this other stuff would happen, but he felt very, very bad. About a year and 2 months later, the planes hit the World Trade Center, and everyone in this guy's office was killed. If this had not happened to him, he would be dead. He was the only one who had lived because he had been fired. And my sponsee and I used to talk about that story a lot. And here was a guy, he wasn't in the program, he had no anything as far as I know. But here's a guy you could look at and go, wow, bad character. Really pulled some seamy stuff. He got his just desserts. Yeah, he's, you know. And maybe God's plan for him was not to die on 9/11. And yeah, it was messy how it happened, and it certainly, but you know what? No one talks about this guy today. No one even really remembers it. I don't know what he's up to, or even whether he's alive or not. But the point of it is that when we look at a situation, we think we know exactly what's going on, either while we're a participant in the situation or as an observer. And the reality of it is, over time, there was a completely different reason for all of this happening. And I'm not sure this was the reason for all of this to happen, but I think he's probably sitting back thinking about this, maybe not grateful, but having a little deeper understanding that he's alive today because of this event that took place that got him out of that office. So I think about that story an awful lot when something befalls another person, and I think, oh, well, you know, if you were working a program, they wouldn't have gotten into that. Mm-hmm. You know, and that wouldn't have happened to them. So, he probably deserved it, and good riddance. You know, after that story, I stop and think and go, wow, it's unfortunate he went through that, but I'm wondering what the full story will be. And I think that's what I have to look at in my life, is when something happens, that's really an upheaval and it's a terrible thing. Well, maybe it's not a terrible thing. It's a terrible thing in the moment. It could be a tragedy with somebody dying or something else, but maybe there's another reason. And over time, that will come to it. And if I have the knowledge that that has happened for other people and I've seen it happen with other people in the program, then I know the same results will happen with me. And then I can really be at peace. And that is the spiritual aspect of the program. You know, I get to take all of the steps and carry them forward into that. Just taking a look at the time here. Okay, so we got a little bit longer for a break. So, are there questions about spiritual practice or the spiritual aspect of the program? The other thing I'll talk about, the next right thing there. Kept that up there for a reason. We never know what's the next right thing. You know, I can pray and say, okay, here's situation A, here's situation B. God, what do you want me to do? I'll say God because it's shorter than higher power. And, you know, a sponsee, or I call my sponsor and say, well, what should I do? Should I take this position? Should I not take this position? He goes, I don't know. I don't know what you should do. I've certainly made direction to people, and it is the wrong direction, and it blows up in their face. And I feel like an idiot. Because I didn't know. I was playing God. So now I go, let's bring God into the picture. Why don't you pray? Because, you know, I had a sponsee call me up the other day, and he goes, you know, this is going on, that's going on with work, and they're doing this, and I'm totally frustrated. I had to just leave and take a day off because I wanted to kill everybody. I'm like, well, you've been saying that for a while. You really are frustrated. And he goes, well, I think I should quit and find another job. I go, tell you what, but do an inventory process. Let's go do the inventory. Let's take a look at why you're so pissed off. I know we've kind of looked at it, but let's really look at this again one more time, and let's see what comes up. So if you're angry at your boss, your co-workers, whatever the case may be, do the inventory, call me back, and then let's go through it. And so we did, and it came out that, you know, he has a boss that really keeps giving him contradictory information, and it's like the same thing all again, and we keep coming back to the same place. They're not hearing him. At the same time, he's volunteering to get involved with things that he doesn't want to get involved with, that take on extra work that he's not getting paid for, and he's resentful for it, and he's resentful at himself. And so we really take a look at the character defects, and you know, at the end of that, he says, I'm going to pray about it, but it's very clear. It's time for me to look for a new position. It's like, okay. And just let me know what comes out of your prayer when you turn this stuff over and release the character defects. We had a call from 2 days later. He goes, yeah, it's very clear. I need to find a new position. I mean, it's not them, but what I'm trying to accomplish there, I can't accomplish. And it's not what I want to do for my living. I want to do something completely different. This was just to earn money while I go work on this other project. And maybe it's time to work on that other project. I was like, okay, if that's what you're feeling, your higher power is telling you, great. I don't know whether he should go work. He could work on another project, and it'd be a total waste of time. And he burns through all his savings, and you know, following a project that just never had a chance of making it. I don't know. Or it could be the next Facebook. I don't know. I don't need to know. But what I do say is, let's bring God into the picture. Then the next indicated action, the next right step, comes into play. We never know it's the next right step when we're taking it. It's only in hindsight that we know that. And so, but what we can do is say, let me go back to my higher power. And as a sponsor, I learned to not be a lay therapist. I'm not there to solve your problem. I'm not there to help you with your marriage. You know, the job thing? I don't know. I don't know whether you're supposed to be there or not. I do know, as a sponsor, I only hear part of the story, yours. And if you ever dealt with enough sponsees, whatever the good is, cut it in half. Whatever the bad is, multiply it by 3. You know, well, I had a little ice cream. I had a lot of ice cream. That's how I interpret that. You know, I'm not going to get a call on like one scoop of ice cream. That's not, no matter what you put it as. You know, someone's like, well, we went out and he was just being irrational, and we went away for the weekend, and it just was being impossible, and it really, I just had to leave. Then I discover you know, the guy basically kidnapped her and held her at knife point and wouldn't let her leave the hotel room because he was drunk. And it was, and everyone had told her not to go away for the weekend with this guy because he was drinking and trying to get sober and was out of control, and she didn't listen. You know, I heard a very sanitized version from her. I was like, oh, okay. So I know with sponsees, I'm never going to get the full story. So, or I'm going to get the edited version or their version. So how can I possibly provide any meaningful advice? I can't. You got to bring God into this and go from there. And then my job is to help facilitate that and make sure that maybe they're going on the right path and will make the right decision. And maybe they do and maybe they don't. And maybe that's all part of the path. So the next right thing, we never know it's the next right thing. And that's where it comes on faith. I'm just going to do this. I'm going to do what's in front of me and keep doing what's in front of me. And I believe this to be the right thing. And if it's not the right thing, my higher power will let me know. There's a prayer by Thomas Merton, who is an American mystic, and you know, he goes, you know, I don't know what your will is for me. I don't know where I'm going. I'm not even sure if I'm doing the right thing or not. But what I do know is that I want to please you, God, and do what you want me to do. So please help me, direct me in that path. I'm paraphrasing tremendously on that, but that's basically the prayer. And that came to him after 13 years of silence, you know, as a monk. And he's written a number of great books on mystical thinking. And, you know, and I think that's an appropriate attitude. I don't know where I'm going. I don't know what I'm supposed to be doing. I don't even know if I'm doing your will, but I'm going to try. I'm going to pray. I'm going to try to do that to the best of my ability. And even if I think I'm doing your will, I may not be doing your will, but I'm going to try and do that. And that's best we can hope for today in the program. It is progress, not perfection. Someone threw out an idea, letting go of the what if. Well, what if this happens? What if that happens? I'm a planner. I like to make contingency plans. Okay, I've got, you know, earthquake stuff. Probably not enough, but, you know, cash on hand, earthquake stuff. You know, well, what if that happened? You know, and the thing is, I can't live my life as a contingency plan. Yes, I need the plan. I need to do all sorts of things. It's like going on a vacation. I need to book the ticket. I need to book the hotel room. I need to go when, oh, you know, I'm going to be there the days when the museum is open. You know, so I make sure that the plans that I'm making will work out. But am I going to have a good time? Is it going to rain the entire time? That I don't know about. So I can make plans and do those appropriate things, but I really have to leave the results up to the higher power. So the what if is, what if that happens? Contemplate that. What if that not so good thing happens? Will I be okay? And that's where we get to see where we are with our spirituality. And if the answer is no, what am I afraid of losing? What am I afraid of not getting? Why is this so important to me? And bring it back to that and say, what is going to happen is going to happen. And that is the what if. So that's how I try and address the what if. Now, I think one of the more spiritual things is being a sponsor and having a sponsor. And I went years without a sponsor, as I mentioned. I tend to be very non-directional. I used to be one of those screamers. So if you really needed someone to crack the whip, really get you in line because you just couldn't get abstinent for more than a week or two, you called me. I'm like, what? You didn't do this? No. Right now, you need to do this, and you got to read this, and do not call me back until you've done your writing. Slam down the phone. And a lot of people like that. A lot of people want to be told what to do. And I really enjoyed yelling at people. And I just thought, and when somehow, someday, I sort of saw myself doing that, and I thought, what am I doing? No, this is not healthy. and I stopped sponsoring for quite a while. And now, I'm like, call me. Let's see how it works. You know, I'm not going to drag you through the steps just to drag you through the steps, because the steps are a tool. And the thing is that a lot of people come into the program looking for a self-improvement course. Well, I'm going to lose weight. I'm going to get it together. I'm going to get, you know, things so I can be in a relationship. And it, no, that's not what the program does. It's a spiritual, help you have a spiritual awakening. That's what the program does. So I'll say, let's get to know each other and let's start to find out what your problem with food is and how can we address that and do so in an honest manner and help you stay abstinent long enough to begin doing the steps. And then we'll get into a very, very specific situation with the steps. Now, if you've never done the steps, then I'm going to urge us to start going through and doing an inventory and really finding out what's there. It'll be an exploration for you. It'll be an explanation for me. And we can discover and use that as a starting point and go from there. And, you know, the nice thing is I don't have to tell them how to live their lives. I don't have to tell them to break up with their boyfriends or their girlfriends. I don't have to tell them whether to move or not. I don't even have to tell them whether they need to, you know, take dairy, food, bread, whatever out of their food plan. It's what's coming back to you. What are you hearing? What are you feeling is the next right move? Your alignment and trying to work on a relationship with your higher power, it'll become clear that you need to give this up and go from there. Because we're all, I mean, we're the world's greatest, you know, dietitians. I mean, you know, I was on my first diet at 7 years old. And so, of course, we can do that because we know what's best. It's just that it never works for us. So why do I think it's going to work for another person? It isn't. So I'm very non-directive. That is my approach. Other people, it's like, look, you need to call me at 6:15 every morning and to show your commitment. And I'll tell you, that does work. That's what helped get me in the program. I met this, when I came in the program, I was 18, going to meetings, said, get a sponsor. I saw this statuesque woman. She was about 6 feet tall, gorgeous. She raised her hand as a sponsor. I was like, oh, okay. And she goes, well, you got to call me at 6:30 in the morning. I wasn't working. It was summer. I was like, every morning at 6:30, I got up and made a phone call, and I got to the meetings. And because I was a people pleaser, you know, I'm like, I'm gonna do whatever she says because I really like her. And after about 2 months, she goes, "This is great, but you need to find a male sponsor." I was like, oh. But by that point, I was hooked into the program. I was used to making a daily phone call, and so, as I said, I'm very non-directive. For me, at that moment, to get me up at 6:30 a.m. to make a phone call every morning to commit my food and what I was going to do and what I had read and do all of that, that got me into the program. That saved my life. My motives weren't very honest, but hey, who cares? Got me into the program. No one's, you know, we don't have to have the most honest motives in the world. We just have to do the work. And sometimes our motives will change because the spirituality of this is so powerful. So there's no right way to do it, you know, and I fired sponsors. I haven't fired sponsors. They usually die on me. That's what happens over time. Sponsees, I don't need to fire them. I just give them a writing assignment, and you never hear from them again. It's amazing. Or they'll call once or twice, and then I'll suggest another writing assignment. I did say, did you do that writing I asked you to do? I don't do that. You know, I said, you know, why don't we do a red light, green light, yellow light food list? Let's start there. And let's see what comes up. And the green light, that's easy. You know, but the yellow light and the red light, let's see where the trigger foods are, the sometimes trigger foods are. And then let's talk about your powerless list. What are you powerless over in your life? And if they do that and it's thorough, okay, then maybe this person is interested. If you don't do it, okay, and then we talk again and something comes up and I'll say, well, you may want to write this powerless list because it sounds like all this stuff is really just tying you up here. This is your ticket to freedom. And usually they don't call back after that. So it's an easy way to get rid of people. Instead of saying, you know, you're not doing the program, I'm going to fire you. I'm very reluctant to do that because, one, I certainly was not all in on day one. My motives were mixed. I didn't understand the nature of my illness and how ill I was, and I didn't understand what you were telling me. What does writing have to do with food? I don't get it. What's the connection? What does calling you at 6:30 in the morning have to do with me being absent and losing weight? So I'm up earlier, metabolism gets faster. What is it? I don't see any connection. You know, I was coming in, you're very linear. I want to lose weight, or I can't control the food every time I sit down, and then it's just killing me. You know, and everyone in my life is angry at me. Just calling you at 6:30 in the morning is going to change that? How? Show me. There's no answer to that. So, you know, I understand. I also have to look at it from the newcomer's perspective. What I'm asking people to do, it makes no sense because it's nonlinear. You know, it's spiritual. There's no straight path. And then to say, trust me, some people do, some people don't. And if they don't, that's okay because they have to go out and maybe they come back 2 years later. And they go, okay, yeah, I kind of get what they were saying. Okay, now I'm ready. Fine. So I didn't slam the door and say, you're fired. I'm rejecting you because you don't understand what's being asked of you and it's really going to save your life and you're being too much of a bonehead to listen. You know, which is the tone I sometimes hear from people. What's that doing? Is that really being kind and loving? You can just as easy get them going on the path, and sometimes you might say, you know, you're calling me in a lot of pain. I'm not your therapist, but you want to talk about this pain, and I've given you some suggestions to alleviate this pain, and I know it will. You don't, but I do. And you haven't done it. What's why? What's holding you up? And that can get the conversation going. Yes?
I have a question. You mentioned kind of knowing that you're being taken care of. It's like this sort of grace and this faith in you. And I'm wondering, for people that sometimes have a crisis of faith that they will be taken care of, like, what has helped you arrive at that? Has it been like a gradual process, or was it kind of like a shift in you where you're like, yeah, I feel it. I feel like I'm being taken care of.
Yes.
Yes.
So you talk about knowing that you're being taken care of and you have this intuitive sense. What brought that about? What was that thing that sort of brought that deep understanding that I was going to be taken care of? Bad shit happening. You're only going to get spiritual when bad stuff happens. If bad stuff doesn't happen to you, no need to get spiritual. This is all theoretical. You know, it's like when I lived in Charlottesville, Virginia, none of us were absent, and we're talking about the fourth step and reading through it. Well, you know, I think that, you know, when you do the... None of us had done the fourth step. We weren't absent. We were talking a lot of crap. It was all theoretical. But then the shit hits the fan, and now my back is up against the wall. I have to do something. Because I'm in a great amount of pain and fear. So I'll do that inventory. I'll turn it over because I don't have a choice. So spirituality comes from pain. I only had to see zero in my bank account and no money coming in and not sure what was going to happen. And my sponsor saying, well, pray about it. You know, or you can do some things that intellectually you disagree with, but... Guess what? Why don't you be grateful that you have that money over there, even though you're not supposed to use it right now? And then start, you know, praying to have that fear removed. And I kept praying so much about it, became an obsession. And then when I let go of it, it was taken away. What happened was I followed the steps that he suggested I do, and I had to believe. I had nowhere else to turn. I had absolutely nothing else to lose. And the pain and the fear, I couldn't sleep at night, was so great. Fine, I'll do it. So, to get spiritual, bad stuff has to happen. If you don't, it's a theory. I get to find out. I got to find out about financial insecurity and having it removed. How? By having a lot of financial insecurity and it not going away. And then me praying about it, the situation not changing. And then the fear being lifted. And then, oh, And then having a sponsor says, oh, but that little insurance thing came through. Oh, so you can pay the rent this month. How'd that happen? I'm like, yeah, okay, I got it. He goes, no, 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 how did that happen? My higher power. He goes, thank you. You know, but I need that. And then after about the 10th time, he goes, when are you going to start believing? You know, it wasn't like I woke up and said, oh, yes, I am being taken care of. I'm good. I wish it were that easy. No, it is. Bad stuff has to happen. And then I have to then turn to the steps and use it, and turn to a higher power and use it, or go eat. And then I don't deal with it. And the opportunity is passed. So unfortunately, people who end up being very spiritual have bad things happen. And so therein lies, don't be afraid of bad things happening.
Because it will.
You know, trying to think of the quote. But that is, so that's how it happens. You will get, there will be, I don't want to use the word test because I don't believe we're tested. I don't think we're tested by our higher power. It's not like, okay, well, let's see if he's really spiritual. I don't believe that my higher power works that way. But what happens is it's the, you know, the old verb and adjective situation. I get to take two paths in a situation. Which one am I going to choose? Same thing's going to happen, but my experience will be very, very different based upon which path I take. Any other questions? About spirituality?
So, let's see. Relationship with sponsor, next right thing. Increasing conscious contact. Letting go of whatever.
Increasing conscious contact, there's a couple of things I do. Listening to tapes. Tapes. My age. Turning on my iPod and listening to talks. Speakers, if I'm going on a long car ride, there's a couple of speakers I like listening to. I go back to the same ones, you know, for inspiration. And, you know, daily practicing gratitude, going outside going, oh my gosh, it is a wonderful day. Or going outside in Beverly Hills, you know, which is fake, plastic, you know. There's just high maintenance people everywhere you turn. You know, it's just. Or I can go in Beverly Hills and I walk out in the morning and go grab my, you know, double espresso and practice my addiction there. And just say, God, it's a beautiful day. And I'm in Beverly Hills. And guess what? 10,000 people are going to show up here today because they want to see Beverly Hills. And it's like some mythic thing, Rodeo Drive. You know? And sometimes I will walk down. I never went into any store. I've worked on about two blocks from Rodeo Drive for 25 years. I never, for the first 19 years, never walked into one single store. And I thought, why not? Well, I'm not going to buy anything. But walk in. See what's there. And I, you know, I walk in, look at the store. Like, and I'm like, oh, where are you from? I'm like, here. I work two blocks from here. I just figured I'd been walking by for 18 years. Might as well check out and see what's going on. They're like, wow, great. You know, they introduce themselves and, you know, sometimes I'll see them around and I'll wave to them and, you know, I get to see what's in that store. Why not? It's a nice display. It's a nice place. They have nice things. And I get to enjoy, you know, the mystique of Rodeo Drive and go, okay, I can see why everyone wants, yeah, I don't quite see why everyone comes, but, you know, I can sort of get it and get into that. Oh, isn't it great to be in Beverly Hills? And I am fortunate to work sort of in an iconic place. Again, it's making decisions to change my perspective and make every moment, if possible, positive and, you know, spiritual. You know, and it's and I can do that in any ways. It's not like I bless the person in the, you know, in the grocery line. You know, I could do that, but I just sort of go out and say, "Gee, look at my life today. It's really nice. It's, you know, I live in a place with fantastic weather and no mosquitoes." To me, I come from Washington, D.C., which was built on swampland. You know, there's flowers in the wintertime, you know, where I live. That's amazing. And I have to remember that. And I can focus on the traffic, or I can focus on the flowers in the wintertime. you know, I get to choose what I'm going to focus my mind on. And as it talks about in Dr. Alcoholic Addict, in one of the stories in the big book, the magnifying mind. I have a magnifying mind, and I can either magnify the positive or I can magnify the negative. The choice is mine. And so I keep constantly trying to do that. And again, it's not living in that Pollyanna world, like, oh, everything's wonderful, isn't it great? You know, step over the homeless person and no, I don't see anything here. It's beautiful. It's not what I'm saying, you know. But stepping over that homeless person, they have a higher power too. They have a higher power too. And they have just as much right to be here as I have. And it's unfortunate, maybe the choices that have happened, that they made, or why they're there, I don't know for sure. But they have a higher power. Everybody has a higher power. You know? And I just hope that everyone gets on the path and follows that higher power, whatever their higher power tends to be. So I get to, you know, every day, I physically, you know, some people say, do a gratitude list. Do 5 things that you're grateful for, and I do that sometimes, and I email it to my sponsor. And it had to be 5 different things every single day. And that got me into the habit of saying, okay, what can I feel good about today? And then what can I do for myself to feel good? I'm going to buy nice clothes. I'm going to buy really nice clothes. You know, and that's something that I can afford to do. I mean, you know, I can show up in my underwear. As long as I'm making money, they really don't care at the end of the day. But I choose to dress nicely. Why? Because it makes me feel better about myself. I don't dress like anybody else in the office. You know, I have longer hair because that's me. You know, in 2008, you know, with Occupy Wall Street, you know, if you work for a Wall Street firm, they really were quite negative, you know. And people would come up and say things to me. You know, I'd be in my blue suit and tie and short hair. And they'd make some, you know, not so great comments. And I was like, wow. So I thought, okay, rule number one, don't look like you work for a Wall Street firm. You know, so I grew very long hair. I just got a cut literally on Thursday, before coming up here. But I usually keep my hair quite long. And I stopped wearing a tie. And I listened to a client. I listened to my clients. I listened to people around me. And to me, this is spiritual. He goes, you know, people who wear ties deliver bad news. I'm like, really? How so? Well, your attorney, undertaker, your agent, doctors under their white coats at a time, judges, and some police officers have ties. Maybe someone is delivering good news with a tie. I thought about that, and you know what? He was right. I don't wear ties anymore. You know, and I'm very relaxed when I go to work, you know, maybe a sport jacket or a suit without a tie and long hair. People are like, well, you're not what I would have expected. I go, yeah, I know. This is who I am. You know, and I've never in 10 years had anyone say anything. And it's amazing. I probably have more business because I'm being my authentic self and following whatever that, and that's certainly not what they recommend. And, you know, I've had the company say, you know, well, you're going to go speak to these new recruits. Could you put on a tie? I go, no. You wanted me to share about why I'm successful. This is why I'm successful, not wearing a tie. Do I dress badly? No. Okay. So what's with the tie? Shows respect. I don't. Yeah, maybe. I said, all politicians wear ties. Do you respect them? So, you know, you just get back to it and they're like, okay, yeah, right, fine, good. You know, but again, it's those little things. There's little things that we can do in our lives every single day. The spirituality doesn't have to be these big grand gestures. You know, I don't have to sell all my possessions and go work with the poor. You know, there are other things I can do. I volunteer my time outside with organizations helping people in various different aspects of society. And, you know, and I enjoy doing that. And people, for the most part, don't know I'm involved. And that's the way I want it. You know, I have to tell my company because they need to know other things I'm involved with. And they're like, well, you were president of this organization? I didn't know that. I go, yeah. I go, who wants to talk to the president? You know, it's the mission that's really important. I'm not important. It's the mission. So I'd rather you know what our mission is and you know what our mission is, right? Yeah. Okay, great. Who cares about the president? You know, that's my attitude on things. So, you know, I can go out there in life and be actively engaged and do those small things to help improve the world in very small ways. And I think that's the thing that we can do today, in a way, is in very small ways, whether it's with our food plan, whether it's sharing with another fellow, whether it's showing up at a meeting when there's the same two people that drive you crazy, and just to be loving and of service and be an example. Because they may not know what it's like to be a member of OA, a recovering member of OA. You're their only chance. And I have to say today, I don't go to the meeting to get recovery. I've got my recovery. I haven't heard anything new in a meeting in a long time that just blew me away. I go to be of service. Doesn't mean I sponsor everyone who walks through the door. When I'm out of service, I go up, hi, how are you doing? You're new. Come back. I've been here a long time. Longer than you'll ever want to be here, but trust me, my life is so much better because of it, and I would be happy to talk to you about why. And do you have a sponsor? There's a list of sponsors here, you know, or, God, you know, there's a great meeting tomorrow. You live over in this side of town? Great meeting. Check out six meetings before you make a decision. And if it's not for you, great. It's not for everybody, but it works for a lot. So with that, I think we're going to stop.